out what it is as a motivator, what it should be as a motivator. It never gets old to learn more about God. In fact, we get sidetracked about all the reasons for doing what we do as Christians. And many times we forget that the central reason for our very existence is to glorify God, to learn about Him, to worship Him, to adore Him, to learn more about Him. I want to read some scriptures and just do that thing. Just kind of see what we can see in these scriptures and that can teach us a little bit more about God. Some thoughts and how those should motivate us to better service. Paul said, turn to 2 Corinthians 5:14. He's arguing his point of his apostleship, and he says, we do what we do for your sake, he says. For the love of Christ constraineth us, because we thus judge that if one died for all, then we're all dead, and that he died for all, that they which live should not henceforth live unto themselves, but unto him which died for them and rose again. And that's a fairly complicated way of simply saying the love of Christ constrains us when we consider that he died for us. And that he rose again for our sakes. That's an interesting word that constrains us. It has the idea of forcing us by a terrific force into only one option. It has the idea of going into a narrow lane, a narrow road with walls on the side. You're forced to go only one direction, up one way, and you cannot go any other way. The love of Christ, a consideration of the love of Christ, just what the breadth of it, how the deep it is, how intensely and eternally and infinitely he loved us, constrains us to service, that henceforth we should not live to ourselves, but to him who died for us and rose again. He did that for us. So to consider the love of God, we could do nothing better than to sit around and think about the love of God, because it glorifies him, and the more we begin to get our minds around just how much he loved us, then we begin to say, Lord, how can I serve you? You'll have to bear with me here. One thought that came to mind about this, about the character, the depth of God's love, is if you think about what Christ, as the second person of the Trinity, the Son of God, when we think about God in eternity, he needed nothing. He just was. I am. He was. He existed. He needed nothing. And he did what he did in the way of creation to display the glories of the goodness of what he is. It's worthy of consideration. And so he created so that would be considered. But think about this. Christ, in the eternal councils, there was God. We've heard about the Trinity on Sunday. God was self-existent, one God in three persons. And it talks about him taking counsel in the councils before time, before creation, before he did anything, he, in the counsels of God, well, there has to be, counsels implies plurality. So the Trinity was coming into play there. He counseled with himself what he would do. And as we talk about that, you can't talk about that other than in ways that we can kind of understand. It's like, it's as though we think of it as though God met together with himself, the three persons got together, and they decided what they would do. Although God doesn't decide to do something, you understand. That's just the way we talk about that. His purpose was that the second person, his second person, the person of the Trinity, would do certain things because of God's love. Theologians talk about the central characteristic of God is holiness. There is a verse that I ran across. Let me find it here. Ephesians 2:4. It simply says, "But God, who is rich in mercy, for the great love that He loved, with which He loved us, even when we were dead in sins, hath quickened us together with Christ. By grace are you saved, and hath raised us up together, and made us sit together in heavenly places, that in the ages to come he might show the exceeding riches of his kindness toward us through Christ Jesus. For by grace are ye saved, not of works," and etc. But my point in that is that God, who is rich in mercy for the great love that he loved us, his love is what produced his mercy. So back of his mercy is love. And back of his love is his holiness. Because of his perfections, he loves perfectly. And because he loves perfectly, he shows mercy. We don't think in terms of priorities about the characteristics of God, but as the one is more important than the other, because God just exists. He doesn't exist with things that change or move or are dependent on others, but all of that was at one point. But this verse shows that for his great love, he showed mercy. So think of it more in terms of prerequisites than priorities. It's not one is more important than the other or greater than another characteristic, but mercy presupposes love. And love, and all of his other characteristics, presupposes that he's perfect. He's perfect in goodness. And the extent of his love, the infinity, the depth of that love that caused Christ to, as it were, to stand up and say, "My Father, I'll go and I'll love them and I will die for them. I will sacrifice myself because of my love for him, for them." But this is, think about this. There's some there's something about the progression of what Christ did that's interesting. He in the councils before time, he said, "I'll do it." In the fullness of time, then he was incarnate. He was conceived in the womb of Mary, and he took on him humanity. He identified with himself with those whom he loved. All this infinite love that we can't even plumb the depth of was focused in an act where he became one of them. He grew to be a man. He suffered, he died, and then the ultimate part of that was that he raised again for their justification, and then he went back to heaven. Job done. Glad that's over. But think about this. His job is not over, and it will never be over. He will never quit becoming one of us. He did not go back to being the second person in the Trinity the way he was before he became incarnate. He will forevermore be one of us. Forever. And because he became one of us, he took on limitations. Certainly during the time he was in the flesh, in our flesh here on the earth as it is now, he was extremely limited. He did not exert those things that except for a couple of little exceptions like the Mount of Transfiguration and a couple of other instances where his glory just kind of burst forth for a moment. But he was limited. But even after he was raised from the dead and took on a glorified body, he took on a glorified body which has much more capabilities than our bodies do. And someday he will pull us to be with him in glorified bodies. He will bring us into the state that he is now. But even now in his glorified body, he is somewhere because he's limited. He's in his body. It's a glorified, and Paul talks about it being a spiritual body. He says, don't you know that it's a body, but it's a spiritual body? Well, we don't know what he meant by that. We have yet to see what all that means. And no doubt, it'll be a way less limited than we are. We know it was because he rose off the ground. He walked through he walked on water. He walked through walls. Lots of things that displayed a little bit of what his glorified body was. And we will be that some. But he will always occupy space. He is limited forevermore. But my point is that he was willing not just to come and suffer and die, but to forever after that continue to be identified with those he loved. And that's just the thought of that. Here he is, the God-man, God himself, who he talked about, Father, glorify me now with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. And the Father granted that, and he ascended, and he sat down at the right hand of the Father, but he was in his body, still in his body. And because of that, and part of the reason for that is Brother Lewis touched on the part of the reason for that recently. Look in Hebrews 7:25. It's because part of what he is as in identifying with us is that he is our great high priest. And he talks about the priests. They were truly many priests because they were suffered not to continue because of death. They all died, and so someone else had to take his place. But this man, because he continueth ever, has an unchangeable priesthood, wherefore he is able also to save them to the uttermost that come to God by him, seeing that he ever liveth to make intercession for them. Forever. Never again will he quit being a man like we are. And then he will pull us to be a glorified man like he is someday, and that will be the ultimate state for us. But he will be there with us in our bodies. He will never, ever quit identifying with us because of his love for us. Now, I want to kind of shift thoughts here and go to, Matthew 14, verse 22. This is right. This is the account of him walking on the water. I want to talk about prayer. I am so thrilled that Brother Lewis has wanted to focus on prayer. For one thing, it has started to Brother Wallace used to talk about reading through the Bible over and over and over through your lifetime, and every time you read, have something, one or two or three things that you're looking for, you know. Find how those scriptures speak to whatever it is that you got on your mind. And so you just search through the scriptures and read it from the question that you have, and it helps inform you about it. So Jesus had just performed a miracle. They brought two loaves and five fishes to him, and he'd fed 25,000 people with it. And straightway, in verse 22, straightway Jesus constrained his disciples to get into a ship. The word constrained there simply means forced. He compelled them to. He would not take no for an answer. He made them get in the ship and to go before him unto the other side of the lake while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up into a mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone. In the account of the five loaves, it mentions that, and when it was evening, he was teaching the people, and when it was evening, his disciples came to him saying, "This is out in the middle of nowhere, they're hungry, let's go send them some food." It says when evening was come. So there are two. The Hebrews had two evenings. One was, and we use this term, so my grandpa used to talk about going into town on Saturday evening. Well, he meant after lunch in the afternoon. But we also use it as evening, as when the sun goes down. It's evening time. Well, they used it the same way. So there's two instances here. When it was evening, his disciples said, they're hungry, and Jesus feeds them. And then later it says that when evening was come, he was alone on the mount in the same day. So two evenings, one is at after lunch, and then one at, say, 6 o'clock when the sun was going down. And I'll get back to why I mentioned that in a minute. So when he had sent the multitudes up away, he went up into the mountain apart to pray. And when the evening was come, he was there alone when the sun was down. But the ship, the boat, it was just a small boat that had oars. There were a few people in it. It was not a big ship. The small ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with the waves, for the wind was contrary. Meaning after dark, they were out, and one of the other accounts of this, one of the other gospels says, they had made it out to 25 or 30 furlongs, which is about 3 miles. They were about 3 miles out, and in the middle of the sea, Jesus was on the mountain, and he could see them out there, either because he could literally see that far, 3 miles. I mean, you could see somebody off in the distance like that, or he supernaturally was seeing them. But the ship was now in the midst of the sea, tossed with waves, for the wind was contrary. It was blowing in their faces. They were trying to go that way. The wind was blowing this way, and they weren't making much headway. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went unto them, walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It's a spirit." And they cried out for fear. You think about it. The ship, this was in the middle of the night. Probably, if there was a moon up above the clouds, they could see a little bit of something. They saw what looked like a man on the top of the water. They didn't know who it was. They'd never seen Jesus do that. They had no idea what it was. And all the spook stories that they'd heard as growing up with kids and their culture around them, they thought, it's got to be a demon. It's got to be a spirit. They were terrified. But straightway, Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer. "It is I. Be not afraid." And then Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it be thou, bid me come to thee on the water." And he said, "Come." And when Peter was come down out of the ship, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw the wind boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched forth his hand and caught him, and said to him, "O thou of little faith, wherefore didst thou doubt?" And when they were come into the ship, the wind ceased. Then they that were in the ship came and worshipped him, saying, "Of a truth, thou art the Son of God." There's an awful lot we can learn about our God in this incident. It is remarkable. The second mention of evening was about sundown. Jesus was on the mountain. The disciples had gotten into the ship either late afternoon or about sundown and had started out across the lake. The wind got up. It was in their face. They weren't making much headway. They were trying to row against, obey him and go to the other side, trying to do what he told them to do, to go to the other side of the lake. They weren't able to do it because of the circumstances. And the amount of time from the time that they got in the ship till the fourth watch of the night is 3 a.m. That's 9 hours, at least 9 hours, that Jesus let them be in the boat toiling in that storm before he comes to them. And, you know, Lord, you should have come a lot sooner to save us an awful lot of anxiety here. No, that the sovereign God left them in the boat. He was praying. He was doing, in his limitation, he needed the time of prayer. That's why he had sent both the disciples away. Then he sent the crowds away, knowing that if the disciples were not hanging around, if the disciples were hanging around, the people would still be hanging around, knowing that Jesus would come back to his disciples. So he sent the disciples away across the ship. He sent the crowds away so he could be alone to pray. I'm reading a lot into this, I know, but it's very logical. He needed time with prayer. He did that frequently. Time alone with his Father. But he didn't show himself to them for 9 hours of terrible, nerve-wracking toil in that boat. And then when he did show himself, they didn't know who he was. They didn't know what it was. They had no idea what they were terrified of the way he revealed himself to them. And you know, we are script writers. Rachel's talked about writing a script that we imagine how things ought to be, and then when they don't go the way that we've imagined them, we've written the script in our mind that how this is supposed to play out, and then we get frustrated when it doesn't play out that way. Well, that's the way we are with God. We come to him, we know that we have a need, we're upset, we're in some sort of trouble, anxiety, troubleness of mind. And we know what God needs to do for us, so we ask him to do that for us. We've written the script, and then God doesn't do it that way. We either start to doubt him or we get mad at him. And if you've never had that happen to you, keep plugging along, it'll happen to you. And it's pretty unnerving when you realize that you're ticked off with God. Here you are supposed to be submissive to him. You're supposed to be, you know, "Lord, thy will, not mine, be done." But that's not the way because he's not following our script, we get upset with him. I mean, I'm just a confession. If y'all don't do that, that's fine. I'm just confessing. That's what I've done and recently. So because it was recent, this when I read this scripture, I just immediately saw all this stuff. You know, wow, he didn't save them from that. He didn't still the storm before they got out on the ship and make it open the you know, the River Jordan so they could walk across on dry land. He let them get out there in the middle of a storm for 9 hours. Then he finally comes to them. But then when they cry out to him, and they cried out for fear, but immediately then, when they cry out for fear, Jesus spoke to them and said, "Be of good cheer. It is I. Be not afraid." And I didn't discover this until just an hour and a half ago when I was kind of trying to pull all this together. And in another version, I checked something else. And lo and behold, "Be of good cheer, I am," is what he said. Don't be afraid, I am. And we worship God. That justifies the notion of just Our reason for being is to glorify God, and the foundational reason for us doing anything we do toward God is to appreciate Him, to love Him, to be stand in awe of Him. Be of good cheer. I exist. I am. Be not afraid. All this stuff that's happening, the remedy for it is not, I'll stop the storm, which he did. I'll save you when you're sinking into the waves, which he did. He finally responded to their need. But the ultimate solution to it was, I exist. I am. Don't be afraid. I am, and I'm perfect in my goodness, in my compassion, my mercy. And because I am as I am with the things that I am, and they exist, I exist as I do, don't be afraid. Be of good cheer. So we serve God out of a glorious compulsion. We're compelled to, when we consider how good He is, how compassionate He is, how kind He is to us, how the depth of His love, what the depth of His love is, and we call on Him because it glorifies Him. Certainly because we have need. Jesus acknowledged when He said, "Love your neighbor as yourself and love your enemies, even as you love yourself." He acknowledged that we are self-centered beings. He didn't chide us for it. It's just a statement of fact. He didn't make me with Brother Hugh's body. He made Brother Hugh with Brother Hugh's body. Brother Aaron was Brother Aaron's body. They look out of their own eyes, not my eyes, and they're concerned about their things. They are their bodies, as Brother Lewis said, their eyelids blink to save their eyes, their own eyes. We are self-centered by the way God made us. So we cry out for, you know, Peter said, "Lord, save me. Save me. I'm sinking." So it's natural for us to do that, but anyway, I'm rambling now. But we our our soul existence is to learn more about God. That'll go on for eternity. And we are compelled, the more we learn about Him and really benefit from the discipline of meditating about Him and reading about Him and studying about Him, we learn what He's like and how He is and why He does. We understand a little bit more about why He does what He does, and it causes us to love Him and serve Him better. I hope this has been a blessing.